Well, boys and girls, I'm back again, and we'll try to redo this bulk of the show that went out today that was so lousy. Terrible Tommy here, so here we go. And I won't have absolutely everything on here, but the important stuff should sound a lot better. Yeah, White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance calling from north central Indiana, near the town of Warsaw, Poland. I mean Warsaw, Indiana, near P.O. Box 401. 46581 is the zip code. And we're here in the bunker today, and we're trying out different things here. You know, if you don't try out new things, you get stale and rusty. So we found out how to minimize and compress these video slots that I'm doing. That's good. I haven't got it perfected over on the Mac yet, though. I'm trying to figure out how to do iTheater or iMovies and take a file off of that. But I do have the photo box, the photo booth, yeah, and I can do it with that too, which I'm doing right now. But I've lost you. I've been lost for a long time, baby. I'm telling you, you think you've been lost? Computers drive me crazy. They're from morning till night. They cause me pain. So here we go. I want to talk about the power of the false narrative today. Yeah. Exclusive. And if you don't understand it, explain it to me. Send me an email. Exclusive. Strategic Communications of Stratcom, a propaganda psyop technique that treats information as soft power weapon to wield against adversaries, is a new catchphrase in the official Washington, obsessed with clout that comes from spinning false narratives, reports Robert Perry. Well, in short, they just lie. They flat out lie, man. They flat out lie. That's the job. They're great at lying. Yeah, not much else. In this age of pervasive media, the primary method, of social control is through the creation of narratives delivered to the public through newspapers, TV, radio, computers, cell phones, and any other gadget they can convey information. And, of course, that's all controlled by a few big super corporations. This reality has given rise to an obsession among the power elite to control as much of this messaging as possible. They sure as hell do. They control it all, except a little bit here on the Internet. So regarding U.S. relations towards the world, we see the State Department, the White House, the Pentagon, NATO, and other agencies pushing various narratives, in other words, various lies, to sell the American people and other populations on how they should view U.S. policies, rivals, and allies, which most of them don't know shit and don't really care. That's the biggest problem. Of course, the sheep have always been that way down through history. They're not different. They're not different today than they were 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago. Basically, they're the same. Human nature is human nature. The current hot phrase for this practice is strategic communications, or STRATCOM, which blends psychological operations, propaganda, and PR into one mind-bending smoothie. I've been following the process since the early 1980s, that's the writer talking there, when Reagan, the Reagan administration, another war criminal, sought to override the Vietnam syndrome, a public aversion to foreign military interventions that followed the Vietnam War. We can't let anything like that stand in the way of a good war, since we've been at war continually since the end of World War II. Or actually the beginning of World War II. To get Americans to kick this syndrome, Reagan's team developed themes about overseas events that push Americans' hot buttons. You hear it all the time. Oh, he's horrible. He's killing off all his people, man. He's bombing his own people. tapping into the Central Intelligence Agency's experience in PSYOPs, targeted at foreign audiences, President Ronald the B actor Reagan, and CIA Director William J. Casey. I can tell you stories about him, personal stories. Casey assembled a skilled team inside the White House led by the CIA propaganda specialist Walter Raymond Jr. You know, Casey died of cancer in the brain, probably induced by radioactive pills or something put under his head. We don't know for sure. He outlived his usefulness. From his new perch on the National Security Council staff, Raymond oversaw the interagency task force to sell interventionist policies, in other words, invasions in Central America and other trouble spots. That's Latin for they're giving corporations trouble, and the people are tired of taking the corporation's shit and being robbed. That's a trouble spot. The game, as Raymond explained it in numerous memos to his underlings, slaves, was to blue belt black hats on adversaries and white hats on allies, whatever the truth really was. The fact that many U.S.-backed forces from the Nicaraguan Contras to the Guatemalan military were little more than corrupt death squads couldn't be true, at least according to PSYOP's doctrine. They're our allies. They are good. They had to be present. Of course, we pay, had to pay through the nose to get them to be our allies. They had to be presented to the American public as wearing white hats. Thus, the Contras became the moral equals of our founding fathers. And Guatemala's murderous leader, Efrem Rios Montt, was getting a bum rap on human rights, according to the words scripted for President War Criminal Reagan, that the Klan almost unanimously all voted for him. I think 100% of the Klan voted for Reagan, even though I told him he was a rat. He was a criminal. He was a war criminal. The scheme, that's why I don't get along with the right. You know, I keep trying to tell them the truth, and they get mad. The scheme also required that anyone, say a journalist, a human rights activist, or a congressional investigator who contradicted this white hat mandate must be discredited, marginalized, or destroyed. A routine of killing any honest messenger. But it turned out that the most effective part of this propaganda strategy was to glue black hats on adversaries. Since nearly all foreign leaders have serious flaws, what do you mean, foreign leaders? It proved much easier to demonize them and work the American people into war frenzy than it was to persuade. Where am I at? Okay. To persuade the public that Washington's favored foreign leaders were actually paragons of virtue. Yeah. Let me see here. I'm doing this wrong. Whoop. Now I'm really screwed up. I went way forward. Okay. I'm going to pick up here. I'm not sure whether I'm in the right spot or not. The scheme also required that anyone, say a journalist, human rights activist, whatever that is, or a congressional investigator who contradicted this white hat mandate must be discredited, marginalized, or destroyed. A routine of killing any honest messenger. And that's been going on for a long time. But it turned out that the most effective part of this propaganda strategy was to glue black hats on adversaries, since nearly all foreign leaders said, I read that before. What the hell's going on here? Once the black hat was jammed on a foreign leader's head, you could say whatever you wanted about him and disparage any American who questioned the extreme depiction as a fill-in-the-blank apologist or a stooge or a pinko or whatever. or some other ugly identifier that would either silence the dissenter or place him or her outside the bounds of acceptable debate. Gee, we got that right here in this country, don't we, boys and girls? Given the careerist conformity of Washington, nearly everyone fell into line, including news outlets and human rights groups. I love that, human rights. If you wanted to retain your respectability and influence, you agreed with the conventional wisdom. In other words, conventional lies. So with every foreign controversy, we got a new group think about the new enemy. Yeah, every time we get done with one enemy, we've already got another one waiting in line. The permissible boundary of each debate was set mostly by the neoconservatives and their liberal interventionist sidekicks. Oh, they wouldn't do that. That this conformity has not served American national interests is obvious. Take, for example, the disastrous Iraq War, the George Bush Jr. War, which has cost the U.S. taxpayers an estimated $1 trillion, led to the deaths of some 4,500 American soldiers and killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, and is still killing them, and unleashed chaos across the strategic Middle East and now into Europe. Most Americans now agree that the Iraq War wasn't worth it, but they won't do anything about it because they say, I can't do anything about it. But it turns out that they're going to vote now for the same kind of assholes they had before. They're all for war. But it turns out that official Washington's catastrophic group thinks don't just die well-deserved deaths like a mutating virus. They alter shape as the outside conditions change and survive in new form. So when the public caught on to the Iraq War deceptions, the neocon liberal hawk pundits just came up with a new theme to justify their catastrophic Iraq strategy, i.e., the successful surge, the dispatch of 30,000 more U.S. troops to the war zone. This theme was as bogus as the WMD lies, but the upbeat storyline was embraced as a new groupthink from 2007 to 2008. The successful surge was a myth, in part because many of its alleged accomplishments actually predated the surge. And that reminds me, remember what we were going to go into Iraq and Afghanistan? We're going to rebuild the cities and the houses and the towns and build schools and all that. There's no schools been built in any of these countries. They just blow the shit out of them and leave. Anyhow, the leader, Abdul Masab al-Zarqawi, both occurred in 2006 before the surge even began. And his principal goal of resolving sectarian grievances between Sunni and Shiite was never accomplished. But official Washington wrapped the surge in the bloody flag of honoring the troops. Oh yeah, gotta honor the troops. Who were credited with eventually reducing the level of Iraqi violence by carrying out the heroic surge strategy as ordered by President Bush, another war criminal, and devised by the neocons. Anyone noted the roles in the story was dismissed as disrespecting the troops. Yeah, if you're against the war, you hate the troops. The only thing I got against the troops is that they're so stupid to fall for this, and even when they know it's a con game, they join up. Can't have much sympathy for them if they get the shit blown out of them when they know in advance that it's a fixed deck, stacked deck. The cruel irony was that the neocon pundits who had promoted the Iraq War and then covered their failure by hailing the surge had little or no regard for the troops, who mostly came from lower socioeconomic classes, in other words, poor whites and poor niggers and poor Mexicans and poor chinks, and were largely abstractions to the well-dressed, well-schooled, and well-paid talking heads who populate the think tanks and op-ed pages in Washington. Oh. safely ensconced behind the successful surge myth, the Iraq War devotees largely escaped any accountability for the chaos and bloodshed they helped cause. Thus, the same smart people, smart criminals, were in place for the Obama presidency and just as ready to buy into new interventionist group thinks. Gluing black hats on old and new adversaries such as Libya's Muammar Gaddafi, Syria's Bashar al-Assad, and, most significantly, Russia's Vladimir Putin. You notice how that's come about? Again, all of a sudden we're anti-Russian again. We were doing real good, and all of a sudden Russia can't do anything right. You realize under Obama, he has shipped out more weapons. Of course, you know that's the only thing that we excel in this country now, is exporting weapons, fighter planes, and everything that goes along with it. He has even surpassed Bush in pushing out of the country and sending military arms to everybody. They light a, they pour the gas on the ground and then wait for somebody to flip a cigarette. In 2011, led this time by the liberal interventionists, the likes of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and the White House aide Samantha Power, the new U.S. military and some NATO allies took aim at Libya. And, of course, the question is why? Scoffing at Gaddafi's claim that his country was threatened by Islamic terrorists, it was not until Gaddafi's military was destroyed by Western airstrikes and he was tortured and murdered that it became clear that he wasn't entirely wrong about the Islamic extremists. No crap. You see, when Gaddafi was the bitter enemy of Washington, he was respected. Yeah, they call him names, but he was respected. When he decided to make peace with the military and industrial complex is when he got in trouble, and they killed him. They see it as a weakness. The jihadists seized large swaths of Libyan territory, killed the U.S. ambassador and three other diplomatic personnel in Benghazi, and forced the closing of U.S. and other Western embassies in Tripoli. For good measure, Islamic State terrorists forced captured Coptic Christians to kneel on a Libyan beach before beheading them. Of course, which gives the Zionist Christians in this country all kinds of an excuse. Oh my God, are Christians being killed? I don't see them ever saying there's white people, there's Aryan people in the Middle East that are being killed. No, it's, well, we didn't care before when there was Muslim, but these are Christian colored people. We got to save their ass. Bring them over here. Fill our towns up with them. Amid this state of anarchy, Libya has been the source of hundreds of thousands of migrants trying to reach Europe by boat to escape at any cost. Thousands have drowned in the Mediterranean, but again, the leading U.S. interventionists face no accountability. Clinton is the forerunner for the Democratic presidential nomination. The power is now U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Also, in 2011, a similar uprising occurred in Syria against the secular regime headed by President Assad, with nearly identical one-sided reporting about the white-hatted opposition and the black-hatted government. Though many protesters indeed appear to have been well-meaning opponents of Assad, Sunni terrorists penetrated the opposition from the beginning. And, of course, when Assad killed these people, they float the stories killing his own people. Well, also in 2011, a similar uprising occurred in Syria against the secular regime headed by President Assad, with nearly identical one-sided reporting about the white-hatted opposition and the black-hatted government. Though many protesters indeed appear to have been well-meaning opponents of Assad, Sunni terrorists penetrated the opposition from the beginning. Because I read that once before. I've been here before. This gray reality was almost completely ignored in the Western press, which almost universally denounced the government when it retaliated against opposition forces for killing police and soldiers and civilians. The West depicted the government response as unprovoked attack on peaceful protesters. Yeah, right. The one-sided narrative nearly brought the U.S. military to the point of another intervention after August 21, 2013, when a mysterious sarin gas attack killed hundreds in a suburb of Damascus. Official Washington's neocons and the pro-interventionists in the State Department immediately blamed Assad's forces for the atrocity and demanded a bombing campaign. Aren't these guys slick in Washington? Aren't they? I mean, they're homicidal maniacs, killers. It's nothing but organized crime. And you know what you have to do to organize crime? You gotta pull it out. Pull their teeth. But some U.S. intelligence analysts suspected a false flag provocation by Islamic terrorists seeking to get the U.S. Air Force to destroy Assad's army for them. Of course it was. That's the kind of silly stuff they play. At the last minute, President Obama steered away from that cliff and, with the help of President Putin, got Assad to surrender Syria's chemical arsenal, while Assad continued to deny a role in the sarin attack. Putin also assisted Obama on another front with another demonized enemy, Iran. In late 2013, the two leaders collaborated in getting Iran to make significant concessions on its nuclear program, clearing the way for negotiations that eventually led to the stringent international controls, which really pissed off Israel. These two diplomatic initiatives alarmed the neocons and their right-wing Israeli friends. Since the mid-1990s, the neocons had worked closely with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in putting a regime change strategy on the board. For countries that were viewed as troublesome to Israel, with Iraq, Syria, and Iran topping the list. You know, this Israel reminds me of a little kid hiding behind big kids on the block. The little kid wants somebody taken care of, and he hides behind the big kids, and he controls through money or give lunch money or whatever the big kids. Putin's interference with that agenda is preventing U.S. bombing campaigns against Syria and Iran. Was viewed as a threat to this long-standing Israeli neocon strategy. There was also fear that the Obama-Putin teamwork could lead to renewed pressure on Israel to recognize a Palestinian state. So that relationship had to be blown up. The detonation occurred on early 2014 when neocon orchestrated coup overthrew elected Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych and replaced him with a fiercely anti-Russian regime which included neo-Nazi, Hollywood Nazis, and other ultra-nationalist elements as well as free market extremists, capitalists. Ukraine had been on the neocon radar at least since September 2013, just after Putin undercut plans for bombing Syria. Neocon Carl Gershman, president of the U.S. government-funded National Endowment for Democracy, of which there is very little democracy around, if you haven't noticed, wrote a Washington Post op-ed deeming Ukraine the biggest prize and a key stepping stone toward another regime change in Moscow, removing the troublesome Putin. Gershman's op-ed was followed by a prominent neocon such as Senator John McCain and Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs Victoria Nuland urged on violent protests that involved firebombing the police. But the State Department and mainstream media glued white hats on the maiden protests and the black hats on the police and the government. Whoa, man. Then on February 20th, 2014, a mysterious sniper attack killed both police and demonstrators, leading to more clashes and the deaths of scores of people. The U.S. government and press corps blamed Yanukovych, and despite his signing an agreement for early elections on February 21st, the maiden self-defense forces, spearheaded by the Hollywood Nazi goons, overran the government buildings on February 22nd and installed a coup regime, quickly recognized by the State Department as legitimate. Though the fault for the February 20th sniper attack was never resolved, the new Ukrainian regime showed little interest in getting to the bottom of it. Other independent investigations pointed towards a provocation by right-wing gunmen who targeted police and protesters with the goal of deepening the crisis and blaming Yanukovych, which is exactly what happened. And, of course, you do know that the European-American banks went into Ukraine, and the corporations want to steal all the goodies out of there. Ukraine's got a lot of goodies. It's very obvious what's going on. These field reports, including one from the BBC, indicated that the snipers likely were associated with the Maidan uprising or the Yanukovych government. Another worthwhile documentary on this mystery is Maidan Massacre. Yet, during the Ukrainian coup, the New York Times and most other mainstream media outlets played a role similar to what they had done prior to the Iraqi war, when they hyped false, misleading stories about WMD. By 2014, the U.S. press corps no longer seemed to even pause before undertaking its expected propaganda role. So after Yanukovych's ouster, when ethnic Russians in Crimea and eastern Ukraine rose up against a new anti-Russian order in Kiev, the only acceptable frame for the U.S. media was to blame the resistance on Putin. It must be Russia's Russian aggression or a Russian invasion. When a referendum in Crimea overwhelmingly favored secession from the Ukraine and rejoining Russia, the U.S. media denounced the 96% vote as a sham imposed by Russian guns. Similar resistance in eastern Ukraine could not have reflected popular sentiment unless it came from mass delusions induced by Russian propaganda. Meanwhile, evidence of a U.S.-backed coup, such as the intercepted phone call of a pre-coup discussion between Assistant Secretary Nuland and U.S. Ambassador Godfrey Pyatt on how to midwife this thing and who to install in the new government, disappeared into the memory hole, not helpful for the desired narrative. When Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 was shot down over eastern Ukraine on July 17, 2014, the blame machine immediately roared into gear again, accusing Putin and ethnic Russian rebels. But some U.S. intelligence analysts reportedly saw the evidence going in a different direction, implicating a rogue element in the Ukrainian regime. Again, the mainstream media showed little skepticism towards the official story blaming Putin, even though the U.S. government and other Western nations refused to make public any hard evidence supporting the Putin did it case. Even now, more than a year later, the pattern that we have seen over and over again is that once a propaganda point is scored against one of the neocon liberal hawk enemies, the failure to actually prove the allegation is not seen as suspicious, at least not inside the mainstream media, which usually just repeats the old narrative again and again and again. Whether it's casting blame on Putin for MH17 or on Yanukovych for the sniper attack or on Assad for the sarin gas attack. Instead of skepticism, it's always the same sort of groupthink with nothing learned from the disaster of the Iraq War because there was virtually no accountability for those responsible. You know, yet while U.S. Press Corps deserves a great deal of blame for this failure to investigate important controversies independently. President Obama and his administration have been the driving force in this manipulation of public opinion over the past 6+ years. Instead of the transparent government that Obama promised, he has run on one of the most opaque, if not the most secretive, administrations in American history. Besides refusing to release U.S. government's evidence on pivotal events in this international crisis, Obama has prosecuted more national security whistleblowers than all the past presidents combined. That repression included a 35-year prison term for Private Bradley Chelsea Manning and the forced exile of indicted National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden, as has intimidated current intelligence analysts who know about the manipulation of public opinion but don't dare tell the truth to reporters for fear of going to prison. Most of the leaked information that you see in the mainstream and media is approved by Obama or his top aides to serve their interests. In other words, the leaks are part of the propaganda made to seem more trustworthy because they are coming from an identified source rather than the named government spokesman. At this late stage in Obama's presidency, his administration seems drunk on the power of perception management, with the new hot phrase, quote, strategic communications, unquote, which boils psychological operations, propaganda, and PR into one intoxicating brew. From NATO's General Philip Breedlove to the State Department's Undersecretary for Public Affairs, Richard Stengel, the manipulation of information is viewed as a potent soft power weapon. It's a way to isolate the damage and damage an enemy, especially Russia's Putin. The Nebanization of Putin makes cooperation between him and Obama difficult, such as Russia's recent military buildup in Syria as part of the commitment to prevent victory for the Islamic State and the Al-Qaeda. Though one might think that the Russian help in fighting terrorism would be welcome, Nuland's State Department office responded with a bizarre and futile attempt to build an aerial blockade of Russian aid flying to Syria across Eastern Europe. Nuland and other neocons apparently would prefer having the black flag of Sunni terrorism flying over Damascus than to work with Putin to block such a catastrophe. The hysteria over Russia's assistance in Syria is a textbook example of how people can begin believing their own propaganda and letting it dictate misguided actions. On Thursday, Obama's White House sank to a new low by having Press Secretary Josh Earnest depict Putin as desperate to land a meeting with Obama. Earnest then demeaned Putin's appearance during an earlier sit-down session with Nitwit from Israel in Moscow. President Putin was striking a now familiar pose of less than perfect posture and unbuttoned jacket, and you know, knees spread far apart to convey a particular image, Earnest said. But the meeting photos actually showed both men with their suit coats open and both sitting with their legs apart, at least for part of the time. Responding to Ernst's insults, the Russians denied that Putin was desperate for a meeting with Obama and added that Obama's administration had proposed the meeting to coincide with Putin's appearance at the United Nations General Assembly in New York. Now, where am I at here? Wait a minute. But the meeting photos, well, no. We do not refuse contacts that are proposed, said Yuri Yushakov, a top foreign policy advisor to Putin. We support maintaining constant dialogue at the highest level. The Kremlin also included no insults about Obama's appearance in the statement. However, inside official Washington, there appeared to be little thought that the endless spinning, lying, and ridiculing might dangerously corrode so-called American democracy and erode any remaining trust the world public has in the word of the U.S. government. Instead, there seems to be a great confidence that skilled propagandists can discredit anyone who dares note that the naked empire has wrapped itself in sheerest of see-through deceptions. There we go. I think that's it. Yeah. So what do you think? I know what I think. They're all a bunch of crooks. And they have to be treated like organized crime instead of the right wing, like a lot of these right wingers that send me email. They're all trying to line up behind some candidate. And I keep saying, what a damn waste of time, you guys. Don't you understand? This is all rigged. It's been rigged for a long time. Well, that's it for this portion. I'll be back with you, who knows, maybe in a couple of minutes.